Episode 3, The Sign of the Times. The first week has now passed, probably the most peculiar week of my life. Very strange knowing that you're a widower. You just don't expect it, especially not in your early 50s. Everything was normal 6 weeks ago. Now I feel life will never be normal again. I've done a lot of thinking during the week. I picked myself up after my first look into the dark world called depression. I don't want another look at that. To be truthful, it's a scary place to be, and I'm glad that I had the strength to escape before it really took a hold of me. I don't envy anyone trapped in that world. I've cried a bucket of tears this week, though I'm no nearer believing that Julia's gone. I can't get my head around it. It just doesn't seem real. I talk to Julia all the time, probably more than when she was alive. I've already made a couple of important decisions over the last few days. To take as much time off work as I need to recover, and to seek counselling after the funeral. I went shopping today. That was so peculiar. Actually, peculiar isn't the right description. Lonely. Very lonely and sad. Quite emotional, in fact. I took over the shopping duties 15, 16 years ago, when Julia had a brain tumour. Since then, I've been used to cooking for the family. Then my daughter left home, so it was just the three of us. Then my son became a vegetarian about 6 months before Julie died and started cooking his own food. So I'd cook just for the two of us, buying things I knew Julie would like. I'm shopping for myself now. I'm buying what I want, though I don't really want anything. It's weird at the moment, but I know it'll get easier. I've got family and friends to talk to if needed. Imagine doing the shopping, then going home to be alone with no family and friends to contact. Just waiting for someone to say hello. Situations like this make me think how lucky I really am. I've been recommended a funeral director called Rob. He's a friend of a friend. I went to see him and came away with a date for the funeral, and feeling like a huge weight had been lifted off my shoulders. When someone dies and you're next of kin, unless you've been in that position before, you haven't got a clue about any of the procedures. And what makes it even worse is that you're not in the right frame of mind for decision making. Rob made the process clear, and I know after talking to him, he'll look after Julie. That's the most important thing to me. Rob is now an extension of me. He's taken my place in a way. He'll put Julie first and treat her with the utmost respect, and we'll work closely to ensure that we respect the memory of my wife by doing everything we can to make her big day as special as possible. I've decided on the most beautiful wicker casket. I refuse to use the word coffin. The casket has no resemblance to a coffin. It's not even the same shape. I've made sure of that. Replacing the word coffin to casket changes the whole outlook on things. In my mind, I've replaced something dark and morbid with something natural and beautiful. Natural and beautiful, like my wife. I know she'd really like the casket and the simple arrangement of roses that are woven into the wicker. Julie's spirit has been released, but her body remains in hospital. The body is just her vehicle while she was on Earth. Though I know that the body isn't Julie anymore, it needs respecting. It shows respect to her spirit. Julie will be happy with what I planned for a big day. She'll be looking down and smiling, I'm sure. The funeral will take place in just under 3 weeks' time. That's 4 weeks since she died. The reason is, Julie's body still hasn't been released, as there's confusion on the cause of death. Was it cancer or a reaction to the chemotherapy? Does it really matter now? What's done is done. It's not going to bring her back. Yes, it's only been a week since she died, and of course, there's an element of bitterness towards the way the whole thing was handled in the hospital. But I'm now starting to think, was it a blessing? Did they do Julie a favour? Why prolong the agony? I know my son was the only other person to see Julie in her last month on this earth, but there's a reason for that. My daughter, who lived around the corner from the hospital, couldn't see her because of the COVID visiting restrictions, and when Julie was dying, she'd gone away for a couple of days as she knew she couldn't visit her mum and thought she was coming home soon. I'm going to tell you something. If you're meant to be there, you'll be there, and if you're not, then you won't. It's not your decision. The decision is made for you. The two people who were strong enough to see Julie in that state were my son and I. I truly believe it would have had a lasting effect on my daughter. She can now remember her mum as the great mother and friend she was, and just remember happy memories. What's meant to be is meant to be. I'm trying not to get too upset about the way the hospital handle things. I know this could really drag me down. Blaming is a defence mechanism. It's easier to blame someone else when you're emotionally hurting. It's natural to lash out. Julie couldn't be saved. The NHS are overworked and underfunded. The nurses and cleaners were amazing. They were so kind and caring and formed a relationship with Julie. The cancer had got a real grip of her by the time she got into hospital. 6 weeks of discomfort instead of months of hell. No, I'm trying to turn my thoughts full circle and find a positive. The truth is, we've been blessed. The good Lord did us a huge favour, which I'm internally grateful. He took that pain away and reunited Julie with her dad. There's another reason why I won't fight this. When Julie had a brain tumour, the NHS did an amazing job, at which I will always be truly grateful. If that tumour was left much longer, then there would have been a good possibility that she wouldn't have survived or been left mentally damaged. I'm so thankful for the extra 16 years I had with her. The kids were only 6 and 11 at the time. To lose their mum at that age would have had a lasting effect on them. All our lives would have been so different. We would have been forced onto a completely different path of life, and God knows where that would have led us. Yes, casting stones isn't the right way forward. It just makes your arm ache. I had a visit from a friend of ours at the weekend. Carl was the first person we became friends with when we moved into the area. He ended up working for me, and even though we'd go long periods of time without seeing him, we always enjoyed his company when he appeared. Carl's a bit rum, but very lovable. Carl and his wife called unexpectedly on Saturday evening. I was just finishing off cooking a risotto when they called. I asked them to sit in the lounge while I just finished off. The lounge has a big leather corner couch, and above it has a ceiling light with three lights branching off, all evenly spaced. Carl and his wife had been sat there for a few minutes when I entered the room. I sat down in Julie's seat at one end of the couch. Shortly after I sat down, the bulb pointing between myself and Carl started to flicker. Within seconds, it had increased to a rapid speed, so much so that the bulb next to it started to flicker. All three of us were just sat there looking at the lights, thinking, what the hell's going on here? Then suddenly, we were all in complete darkness. The electrics in the house had tripped. Now you might think that could happen at any time. Well, those lights had been up there for over 10 years, and one bulb has never flickered on its own. If the dimmer switch isn't turned up enough, then sometimes all three will flicker, but never one. On this occasion, the dimmer was turned up full. The bulbs have never blown when they flicker. The only time that they might blow is with the surge of energy when you first turn the switch on. And in the 16 years we'd lived in that house, the fuse board has never tripped. To this day, only two of the bulbs work. Not because it damaged the light fitting, but because I refused to change the blown bulb in memory of the message Julie sent when saying hello to Carl. The messages from Julie were coming thick and fast. I'd had signs every day. In a spiritual sense, she'd hit the ground running. She'd received and fully believed in signs from the dead while she was alive, and she knew my spiritual door was wide open to receive these messages. The messages really helped. She knew I was struggling. She was saying to me, I'm still with you, you're not alone. When I had company, I was okay, but when I was on my own with time to think, then that could be heartbreaking. People say, keep busy. In my experience, that's totally the wrong thing to do for two reasons. Firstly, when you suddenly stop being busy, you're not ready to face the truth and you tend to crumble. And secondly, the most important thing that you need to do to fully recover and stand up straight again is to think. No matter how hard it is, you need to delve deep into your mind, sink into your thoughts, realize what you've lost, and in time you'll appreciate what you still have. Be honest with yourself. If there are any demons or regrets, face them head on and realize that there's nothing you can do about them now. If you need to make a compromise to ease or make sense of a problem, then do that. Accept the situation and move on. Tally the good compared with the bad. There's always good, but if you feel sorry for yourself, you'll only look for the bad. Looking for pity is ugly. It's also a sign of weakness. Though it's not meant intentionally at times, it can be classed as selfishness. When you look for pity, you affect everyone around you. You draw their energy. Inadvertently, you're dragging them down to the level that you're at, instead of getting a grip of the situation and climbing up to where they are. Why do we do that? Because it's easier. We have to realize that looking for comfort from someone and looking for pity are two completely different things. Something else that you might have to do is reevaluate your life to eventually move forward. Don't be afraid to make big decisions that put you on a different path of life. If you feel that you were stagnating in your past life, or a certain individual was drawing your energy from you, then make the brave decision to change that for the better. I've rid people from my life in the past, and I know it was the right thing to do. When you come to any junction in your life, like a bereavement, a breakup, a serious injury or illness, take that opportunity to seriously think about the rights and wrong in your life. Life is not a dress rehearsal. This is your one and only chance, and it's not selfish to change things that are negatively affecting you. This is your chance to change a negative into a positive. Before making any life-changing decisions, give yourself plenty of time to think. Listen to your inner self, but most importantly, be honest with yourself. You can't fully move on in any situation in life unless you're honest with yourself. My son once asked me during one of our deep conversations, if you were to give one piece of advice, what would it be? I replied without hesitation, look deep into your soul and be 100% honest with yourself. Honesty is the best policy, but if you truly want to move forward in life, it's the only policy. Even after just a week or so, I truly fought something that died in me. It sounds dramatic, but it's the only way I can describe the way I felt. I truly felt I'd never be the same person again. That bubbly, boisterous character was gone. I felt totally deflated, subdued, a shell of my former self. I felt a part of me had floated off with Julie. It was as if I was looking at myself from afar, thinking, who are you? Something else I felt at that time was the love that people showed me. More love than I'd ever expected or had ever experienced before. People weren't bombarding me with visits and phone calls. They knew that just wasn't me. I liked to be left alone, and they somehow knew that. I'll never forget the love they all showed, the camaraderie. That's the best way to describe it, the camaraderie. The camaraderie was another positive I added to the other positives. The positives were now starting to stack up, and each time I found a positive and mentally classed it as 1% of my sorrow being erased. 1% doesn't seem a lot, but add them all up and suddenly you start to see the light at the end of the tunnel. You start to think, I'm getting there, I can do this. Think of it like someone on a diet. You stand on the scales and see that you've only lost a pound and you don't feel much enthusiasm. But keep going with the diet, and when you've lost 6 pounds, you feel completely different. Pride comes into play, and so does momentum. Pride and momentum are vital when trying to achieve anything. Noticing the positives are vital if you're going to stand up straight again and thrive. There were a few times in my recovery when I would notice a positive and grab it with both hands. During week two, one of the biggest positives appeared. I decided to visit one of my best friends, Rob. I'd worked with Rob on and off for about 15 years. He said something to me that day that helped me more than he could ever know. I called around to his workshop just to say hello and to tell him that I was okay. I was just about to leave when he said to me, "If anyone can handle Julie's death, it's you, because you're the most pragmatic person I know." I said, "Thanks, mate." As I got back in my van, I thought to myself, what does pragmatic mean? I had a rough idea, so I googled it. It basically said to do things in a sensible, realistic and practical way. I thought about the way I go about life and work and realised that I was pragmatic. From that moment on, a neon sign shone in my head with the word pragmatic. I said to Rob the next time I saw him, "You don't know what you did for me that day. It helped me so much. Every time I started to get a bit down, that neon sign would shine in my head and I was reminded who I was, the way I handle things, and that I could do this because somebody who I'm very close to, who knew God knows how many people, had basically said, there's nobody quite like you." I needed Rob to tell me that. These are the clues to survival. You have to recognize when these little nuggets appear. It made me proud that somebody who I respect thought that way about me, and pride is a great thing when used in the right way. The number 24 is ingrained in my mind. I keep saying to myself, don't forget the 24th, don't forget the 24th. The 23rd is the date of the funeral. We pick this date as it gives us plenty of time for the body to be released and prepared and to give immediate family the chance to see Julie if they please. I know the 24th is the first day of the rest of my life and I want to be ready for it. I'm preparing myself in the same way I did after the episode of depression. If I'm fully prepared for the 24th and I drop like a stone after the funeral, then I'll only drop halfway from where I'll be able to recover. If I'm not prepared and I drop, then I know I'm in massive trouble. Be one step ahead at all times. Get used to seeing danger in advance. People say to me, "You're OCD. I don't think I am, but maybe I am, as a few people have said this to me now, and sometimes others see your mannerisms clearer than you do. If I am, obviously it's not a bad thing when you use it to your advantage. Many so-called mental defects can be turned full circle to not only be used to your advantage, but to put you one step ahead of the crowd. Don't hide away if you feel that you're a little different to the average human. Use it to your advantage. It's nearly 2 weeks since Julie died, and even though I'm putting on a good show and surviving, the overriding way I feel is, I just want to die. The sorrow I feel is horrendous. It's like nothing I've ever felt before. When your heart just keeps dropping on a regular basis, that sinking feeling, it's absolutely awful. I just want to be with Julie. I can't see or think of anything else. I know I have my children who I love dearly, but when you love someone the way I love Julie, you just want to die and be with her. Julie was always my number one. People say your children should be your number one. No. Without Julie, there would be no children. In my eyes, your children should see how much you love their mum, and as a man, they should see how much you respect women. My children know how much I love their mum. I'm glad that they could see that. I loved her long before they were born. I feel proud that she chose me to father her children. I used to look at her with a smile and think, you're the one who had my babies. I've just had news from Rob, the funeral director, that Julie's body is ready to be released. Rob's going to pick her up and get her prepared. I can't wait to see her. It's bizarre that I say that, as the last two bodies I saw in the chapel arrest, my brother and my nana, freaked me out a bit, and after seeing them I swore I'd never view another dead body again. But for some reason, I'm as giddy as a kitten. The first time I went to see Julie's body in the chapel of rest, it felt like a first date. I was so excited. It seemed like an eternity since I'd seen her. I parked up in the car park of the funeral directors and hurriedly walked to the entrance like a child who'd been told to stop running in the corridor at school. Robert prepared Julie on a mobile trolley with white satin sheets and a cushion for her head. I was so glad that he'd not put her in a coffin as we were waiting for the wicker casket to be made. I felt like Julie had freedom, not imprisoned in the tall, rigid walls of a coffin. She looked so much better than I thought she would do. Her body had held up really well, and there was only the sign of some graying around the fingertips. She was obviously cold and firm, but she was Julie. I remember I held her hand and gave her a kiss on the cheek and told her it was so good to see her. I was just so relieved that I was with her again. I said to her, "I'm going to bring you one of those new pillows that you like." I thought she'd be really comfortable with one of them under her head. It was rare that Julie commented in a positive way on anything that I'd got her, but I must have done well when I got those pillows as she really liked them. I knew the pillow wasn't going to make any difference to her now, but I just wanted to look after her, as I'd always tried to do. She was still my wife and the love of my life. She'd be looking down and be happy that I was caring and respecting her. It was easy to come and see her that day, though very hard to leave. But the saving grace was, I knew she was in safe hands with Rob. This was another positive I took. I hadn't known Rob for long, but I trusted him. Rob was real, one of us, not someone in a suit who I couldn't relax or relate to, who wasn't on the same page as me. To know Julie would be looked after and respected was huge for me. It was one less thing to worry about. It was a massive tick in my head. The date was now confirmed, and as the funeral approached and her big day arrived, Julie would produce one of the biggest and most beautiful signs to help me, just when I needed it most.